From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the State House defies its Republican leaders and says yes to a tax incentive to attract businesses to Michigan. Plus, the president's budget slashes federal funding for scientific research. Another superpower is poised to take over from the U.S. as a world research leader.
China has been steadily increasing in terms of the percentage of its investments as compared to the United States.
The struggles of living paycheck to paycheck in Michigan.
Unlike, you know, some popular misconceptions that are out there, you know, these are folks who are really trying their best to get ahead, but sort of no matter what happened, there were roadblocks.
And the Michigan ghost town of Pear Cheney.
Certainly by the Great Depression, everybody had pretty much moved out of there and abandoned the town.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who are the so-called working poor in America?
Unlike, you know, some popular misconceptions that are out there, you know, these are folks who are really trying their best to get ahead, but sort of no matter what happened, there were roadblocks.
Later this hour, we'll look at the roadblocks to upward mobility for families who are scraping by paycheck to paycheck. Plus, how did Pear Cheney, today a ghost town, get its name? Our partners at the Michigan History Center answer an Am I Curious question. But first, Michigan's lawmakers are in session today, the only day this month. And the House used this day to vote on a major new tax incentive for business. And it was a lively debate.
Here we go again, doling out corporate welfare. How ironic, taking from the poor and giving to the rich.
We are essentially in an arms race, not only with our bordering states, but the entire country and the world.
We're not going to reduce your individual income tax rate. And by the way, we're going to take your income taxes and we're going to give it to a large foreign corporation.
It's an opportunity to bring Michiganders back who left the state when their jobs were eliminated, to return workers back to work who have been underemployed, unemployed, downsized, and displaced.
And in the end, the tax incentive package passed. It was a vote that defied House GOP leaders and Speaker Tom Leonard and served up a great big win for Governor Snyder. Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are here with us now to break it all down. Rick, remind us again, what does this package do?
This package, we should note, it passed with bipartisan support over bipartisan opposition. And what it does is it creates a great big fat targeted incentive for businesses that create hundreds or thousands of jobs that pay well, that pay average or above average wages, depending on the size of the company. And it was derided by Republicans and Democrats as corporate welfare. And it was embraced by Republicans and Democrats as a necessary tool to attract jobs. Specifically, what it would do, and we heard that referenced in the montage, is it would allow these big companies to keep all or part of the income taxes that would otherwise be paid by their employees. And as you can imagine, that raised the hackles of some people.
Now, let's just stop for a second and take note of what Rick just said, which it is 2017, and we are talking about a bill passing with bipartisanship. Okay. Oh. Now carry on.
Yes, and just we will be digging into that because, yes, let's let that be the backdrop. Rick, were you surprised this thing passed the House today?
No. This was something that even though the House leadership opposed it, that they got enough pushback from the business community. And it wasn't Governor Rick Snyder who made this happen. It was business leaders, groups like Business Leaders for Michigan, that came in and leaned on the Republican leadership and said, look, oppose this if you must, but at least allow it to go up for a vote and we'll make it happen. And that's exactly what happened.
And who likely made some deals with Democrats to get their votes.
Who absolutely made some deals with Democrats to make this happen.
In fact, indeed, Zoe, let's talk about how we kind of got to this point today because of what happened in the House last month.
Right, exactly. And this was that, as we've talked about, this has been sort of Governor Snyder's number one issue that he wanted done. And the governor's this summer and the governor and his administration and the folks who work for him were working very hard to get it done. And when they realized that some very conservative Republicans weren't on board, well, they decided to go and look for some Democrats and to make some possible deals with Democrats. And it sounded like last month that there was possible deals with Democrats that the governor wouldn't sign or basically say okay to anything that had to do with union deals, some deals the Dems didn't want.
Labor relations,
in order for them to give the vote. And so then it sounded like Speaker Leonard found out about this deal and was like, oh, no, you didn't. And basically
guess what?
Said to his fellow Republicans, this is not okay. They decided to caucus and they decided not to hold this vote. And it got a little heated there. Leonard told reporters, you know, I want to look the governor in the eye and have him tell me that, you know, what he did. And now they looked in each other's eye and they've said some kind of kumbaya. But there obviously was a continued deal with Democrats because today it passed with some Democratic support.
Actually, it was pretty much 50-50, that it was half the Republicans for it, half the Republicans against it, half the Democrats for it, half the Democrats against it. And, remember that this was the governor who a few years ago, after saying, you know, this is not on my agenda, basically had right to work forced on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so Republicans didn't want to take that card off the table of, you know, I mean, maybe we could do this again if we see an issue that's important enough to us.
Mm-hmm. And here you have the entire House GOP leadership team voting no. I mean, Rick, how often do we see something pass with all the leaders voting against it?
Well, not very often.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, you look up at the board and there's the voting board and you can see the names and, you know, the people that vote yay, it's green, and the nay are red. And there in red are the Speaker of the House and the Chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee. And it was very interesting that they still let this vote go forward, even with a lot of support against it.
All right, so let's talk about put this into context on what we're seeing here. What does what happened today tell us about relations between the governor and House Speaker Leonard and other GOP House leaders? I mean, what could it mean for the remainder of Rick Snyder's time in office?
I think what it means is that there is still a Snyder administration with an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Because if somehow this had all collapsed, I think that this would have meant that the governor's ability to negotiate with the legislature is basically done. And it showed that they could still come back and repair things, even, you know, after, you know, a collapse like this.
And we've seen this movie before with the governor and legislative Republicans, where, you know, they have not always been on the same page. And there's been some very sticky issues. Sometimes things pass, sometimes they don't, but they've, you know, gotten back to being able to work together. We saw some issues with the budget, whether it was going to pass, a few weeks ago. It did, and I think we're kind of back on a path now. What'll be interesting now that good jobs, that's what this legislation is called, you know, as opposed to bad jobs legislation, good jobs has been passed, that we'll kind of see what is on the agenda now for the fall and what happens moving forward and what does this relationship look like.
Although I think this is a bit of a departure from the template that we've seen in the past, that when you look at, for example, road funding, when the governor had to swallow a lot less than what he wanted, that this really went through largely as the governor and the business community designed it and asked for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he got what he wanted. Now, I'm wondering about the GOP members of the House who defied their leaders and they voted yes. Could they be punished for not following Speaker Leonard's lead?
I don't think by the speaker per se. I mean, he allowed it to come up for a vote. And
yes,
a speaker, a legislative leader, both leads and follows, is that you lead by the consent of the lawmakers that you are leading. So I don't think that we'll see any issues there. What we might see are issues in, say, Republican primaries where groups like the Michigan Freedom Fund
Americans for Prosperity.
Yeah, which were really, you know, working hard against this, saying, you know what? We're going to try and make you pay a political price from deviating from conservative orthodoxy on this question of using targeted incentives to attract businesses.
Now, I want to go back to what you pointed out, Zoe, at the very beginning of this conversation. Look, the governor talked to Democrats, and look, enough of them said yes to push this good jobs package through.
Yeah.
Goodness, did taking a bipartisan approach actually pay off?
I know. Well, it appears here, if you were for this bill, that it did. And you have to wonder, is this going to open up some new conversations about negotiations? I've said it before, and I'll say it again, this idea that, you know, would this governor have been able to get more done, whether it was, economic issues or education issues, if he had a Democratic legislature? That is something we will not be able to figure out. He, of course, is term limited. He will be out, and he has, you know, a Republican legislature. But, you know, what will this mean going forward? And what will it look like if there were deals made about whether or not he would support any more labor or union initiatives that could come up?
What do you think, Rick?
I think this is more issue specific. This got across the finish line because the business community, and especially the Southeast Michigan business community, leaned heavily to get this done. The question is, what other issues are there going to be like that where you've got a group with that kind of clout pushing for something? We should not exit this talk without pointing out that, you know, speaking of deviating from orthodoxy, Governor Snyder had to deviate from his own position on how these incentives work, that this is picking and choosing winners and losers. This is economic hunting. This is not the gardening that's supposed to create particular conditions across the board in order to attract businesses.
Something that Republicans just were always up in arms about when Jennifer Granholm was governor and, you know, would say she was picking winners and losers when it came to wind and solar energy and things like that. And now here you go.
Movies and films.
And now you've got Republicans going, hey, Foxconn, this, you know, group that is talking about bringing 5,000 jobs to Southeast Michigan, build, you know, high-tech video screens, are going, well, wait, actually, maybe these are some, you know, good jobs, no pun intended, and, you know, here's what we're going to do to try to get them.
And how much does today's vote move that proposal of Foxconn closer to reality for Southeast Michigan, do you think, Rick?
The people who are arranging this say it puts Michigan in the game. The issue that this was supposed to deal with is that the states that we compete with, Texas, Georgia, South Carolina, you know, not to mention, you know, our neighbors, Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, all have incentive programs that run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Michigan's is pegged at about $69 million a year. And they said that just, we can't do that. And that's the way that these programs have always been defended historically. It's not that we like it or dislike it. It's just the reality that all states are doing this. And if you're not, then you're not in the game. And as we've seen, that no one has a strong enough gut belief in real economic gardening that they're willing to abandon it.
Our It's Just Politics team of Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. As always, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
You bet.
Coming up, we discuss what drastic cuts for science and research could mean for the United States.
It ends up being a disincentive for young people to really think about going into science.
That comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
And it is time for another round of Am I Curious? You ask whatever question is on your mind, and we dig up the answer. For today's question, we get to say hello to Michigan Radio listener Olivia Cushway of Ypsilanti. Hey, Olivia.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. So what is your Am I Curious question?
I was wondering what happened to the ghost town of Pear Shady. I had kind of stumbled upon it online, and I was first off really amazed that there was ghost towns in Michigan. That kind of reminds me of the Wild West. But it just really got me curious and wanted to know more about what happened to it.
Very good. Well, we've got the perfect person to answer your question, one of our partners at the Michigan History Center. Steve Ostrander is here with us. Thanks for helping out with our Am I Curious question, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, where is, or more correctly, where was Pear Shady located?
Pear Shady is located about 12 miles southeast of Grayling. It's in the area up there that they call the Pine Plains. It's in Beaver Creek Township. And if you're a bird watcher, you would know this area because this is Kirtland Warbler habitat area.
Okay. So how did it get its name? Let's start with that.
In 1873, a man named George Haney received a land grant from the Michigan Central Railroad to establish a stop on the railroad tracks, which at the time was called the Mackinac Line, and at the Mackinac Line ran from Bay City to Mackinac City. And Mr. Cheney also established the Cheney House Hotel, and he was proprietor of the hotel there.
So what led to the town being established? What time period are we looking at?
This was in 1873 that he received his land grant. And the railroad, when they were building lines, they needed stops on the line. And these stops would be places where they would take on water, they would take on freight, they would pick up and drop off passengers. So that was the main reason why they wanted this stop established. And so the town supported mostly the logging industry up there, and they employed lumberjacks, teamsters, cooks, timber cruisers, people like that. And so they were cutting pine timber in the area, and there was a secondary industry up there of people, tradesmen like wagon makers, blacksmiths, storekeepers. There was a sawmill there, a general store, a hotel, a post office, a railroad depot, and there was even a doctor living up there.
Well, it seems to be things were humming along a pretty normal path of development for Pear Cheney. What happened to turn it into a ghost town?
Well, there was several reasons for the demise of the town. Number one, and I always found this an interesting story, there was an election held in Grayling to determine what would be the county seat of Crawford County. And because the election was in Grayling, the residents of Pear Cheney had to walk 12 miles up the railroad tracks to Grayling to vote in the election. And for whatever reason, whether some of them just didn't make the trip, they were outnumbered in the election. Grayling won the election, and so Grayling became the county seat of Crawford County. Later on in 1881, the Michigan Central Railroad established the headquarters of the Mackinac Division in Grayling and passed Pear Cheney by, so that was another reason. Also, Grayling is, if you're familiar with your Michigan geography, you would know the Ausable River flows through Grayling, and that supplied water power to run mills there, and there was no river in Pear Cheney, so Grayling had that advantage as well. And another reason is once all the trees were cut around Pear Cheney, the land up there, the soil is very sandy and not really conducive for agriculture. So there just wasn't a lot that people could do in terms of farming around there.
And no scenic lake like, for example, you have in Grayling where people can enjoy that as well. So there really wasn't a lot of reason to go to Pear Cheney anymore?
No river, no lake really close to Pear Cheney. I've been there several times. There's just a lot of pine trees up there, jack pines. And, you know, if you like to birdwatch, it's a great place to see Kirtland warblers. But other than that, there's just not a lot going on there.
Any remnants of old buildings?
No, because of vandalism and forest fires, all the buildings have been destroyed. There is a cemetery there, and the cemetery is rumored to be haunted. There are rumors floating around on the internet and from talking to people that if you go out there that you may see former residents out there. But I've been there many times, and I've never seen anything out of the ordinary there. Just a peaceful cemetery there where a lot of the residents are, you know, in their final resting place.
So it seems like it was done in by the economy with the logging changing, with geography. If you had to walk 12 miles along railroad track to vote, I guess a lot of people said, forget it. And then, yeah, the politics, all of that.
Yeah, the town reached its peak of about 60 residents, and that would have been around the turn of the century. And really by the teens, there were not that many people left there. And certainly by the Great Depression, everybody had pretty much moved out of there and abandoned the town.
There we go. Olivia, any follow-up question you'd like to ask, or did Steve pretty much answer your questions?
That's so interesting. I didn't know a lot of that. I had read a lot about diphtheria wiping out the town through disease. Was that something that was real? I know I saw a lot about the folklore as well with the haunted cemetery, but it seems kind of more like something kids go do at night.
Yeah, that's a good question. You're right. There were epidemics that went through the town. In fact, when I was doing research and writing an article about the town, I did a survey of the cemetery, and I found one grave where the parents were buried, and three children were buried with them that died as infants and died, I think, within a time span of about a month. So it was either diphtheria or cholera or something like that that took them, but it was very sad.
Interesting. And yes, we do have ghost towns in Michigan. Olivia, we're doing a series on them, so you just keep listening to Stateside. You'll hear about more. We've had some already on, and it is interesting. As you say, we think Old West and ghost towns, but they're definitely in Michigan as well. Olivia, thank you so much for listening to Michigan Radio and for your Am I Curious question.
Thank you. I really appreciate being included. It's awesome.
And Steve Ostrander, Michigan History Center, thank you so very much for sharing all of your great Michigan history know-how with us. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Work continues in Washington on the budget for the new fiscal year, and all signs point to drastic cuts for science and research. The scientific community is sounding clear warnings about what it would mean for the United States if that happens. A new analysis by University of Michigan researchers finds the United States would lose its top spot in science. And there is a big competitor ready to leap ahead, China. Here with us is the senior author of this study. Dr. Bishr Omari is the chief scientific officer of Michigan Medicine. Doctor, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
Now, your study really does come at a very important and many would say worrisome time in the future of federal funding for science research. What questions were you seeking to answer in this study?
We went in without having any preconceived notions. We just wanted to collect the data. But there's been quite a bit of talk about concerns really about the decrease or the flattening of the NIH budget. And in fact, that has been reflected by a number of investigators not being able to get their research funded because of the pay line that the NIH uses to decide whether a grant is funded or not has been decreasing over time.
Of course, we're talking about National Institutes of Health, the NIH funding. To understand how you did this study and what you found, let's first talk about what one might call the currency of modern science, because that's why you and your team did a deep dive into 10 scientific journals. So explain the importance of peer-reviewed basic science and clinical research papers and where they're published.
Any investigator who has a hypothesis, he or she would test their hypothesis. They would come up with a set of findings. And the way to disseminate that knowledge is really to get it published. And I would say most, if not all investigators, they aim to publish their work in the journal that has what is considered the highest impact. Now, that doesn't mean that a mid-level impact journal doesn't publish outstanding work. In fact, sometimes foundational work is published in mid or even lower impact journals because the reviewers maybe didn't believe it. So it may not receive kind of the high priority score for these higher impact journals. But in general, most investigators would love to get their work published in these higher impact or high tier, if you will, journals. So we decided to take a sampling of three of the highest impact journals that publish clinical research and three that publish more basic or translational work. And then we did two kind of mid-level clinical and two mid-level basic. So that was kind of our starting point.
And looking to basically figure out what was published and where did they come from and who was it? What did you find?
Exactly. We wanted a reasonable period of time. So the years that we looked at were 2000, 2005, 2010, 2013, and 2015. And I should give a lot of credit to Marissa Conti because she actually did a lot of the legwork for this. And what she did, and also with some students who helped with this project, is look at every single research paper, every single one. And there's a lot of data out there, but one of the limitations of the analysis is that we looked at a small sampling. But one of the strengths, I would say, is that it's quite detailed. It looked at every single paper, looked at the list of authors, and also where the work came from. Is it primarily a U.S.-based study, or is it a U.S.-based, but it also includes international collaborators? And in doing so, looked at where the research came from any country, no matter which country it came from.
And the top of the heap, if you're looking at ranking nations in terms of the amount of research that's getting out there, would be?
So fortunately, the United States is at the top of the heap. That's the good news part of this. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the United States was in the year 2000 and continues to be in the year 2015 at the top of the heap. But the thing that maybe we were surprised about is that, in fact, for example, the U.S. accounted for roughly 44% of the top papers that were published in these top journals in the year 2000. But then there's been a steady drop from 44%. It's really been steady to about 37% in the year 2015. But the thing that...
Going in the wrong direction.
Going in the wrong direction, unfortunately.
Yes,
exactly. But if you then look at what other countries, for example, Great Britain pretty much stayed at second place throughout, but they also dropped. So they were roughly about 8% or so, but then they decreased to about 4% during that same time frame. But again, if you look at the top 10 countries, China was not among those top 10 countries in the year 2000. But then in the year, for example, 2005, they were ranked 10th. So they jumped into the top 10. In the year 2010, they were number 8. In the year 2013, they were number 5. In the year 2015, they're number 4.
So it's clear that as you're seeing the United States, Great Britain, still holding their top places, they're dropping. China is coming on. It sounds like China's coming on like gangbusters.
They are coming like gangbusters. One thing to keep in mind is that although China has been going up, if you look at the output, let's say, of papers published by investigators in the United States, the output for China is 1.4% of those papers. It's still a small percentage compared to the 37% of the United States, but they were nowhere in the top 10. So I think that in and of itself says quite a bit.
It says to what, as far as...
It says that China has been able to encourage their investigators somehow and create the environment that allows research to be published in these high-impact journals, whether it's clinical or whether it's basic science research. And one question that comes up is, how much is each of these countries investing in research and development? And also, if you look at those sorts of numbers, again, China has been steadily increasing in terms of the percentage of its investments as compared to the United States.
So then as we think about funding, you say you're seeing this downward trend. Is that related to associated drop in funding?
Well, it certainly correlates with that. You know, one has to be careful. You don't fix things by simply dropping money to it. But at the same time, certainly resources, I think most would agree that if you simply just look at the percent funding in the NIH, I mean, far fewer investigators are being funded. It's leading some investigators to maybe retire early. But most importantly, and the thing that I think a lot worry about, is that it ends up being a disincentive for young people to really think about going into science, because they're looking at their mentors and teachers who seem to be struggling because they have to spend a lot of their time writing grants instead of doing research.
We heard very much the same kind of theme when we talked with the University of Michigan biology professor Megan Duffy, concerned about declining funding and what it's saying to the next generation of young scientists. So what do you see would be the effect of proposed cuts in funding to the NIH, to the National Science Foundation? Where do you see that impacting the research and discoveries that Americans can do? Because that's being looked at right now in Washington.
Well, the cost of research is definitely going up. One positive thing, in fact, that also came out of this analysis is that team science is increasing. And that's one reflection of that is how many authors from how many countries are involved in a particular study.
So let's all get together and kind of pool our brain power and our
expertise.
Our
exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So that's a very positive thing. But doing science actually in many ways has gotten a little bit easier because the technology has advanced so much. But being able to advance research will require investments. I mean, if one looks, for example, the cost of a B-2 bomber, I think, is roughly $2 billion. The budget of the NIH for 2017 is about $34 billion. And it's been great because there was a so-called doubling of the NIH budget, and that started in 1999, when at that time the budget was about $15.5 billion. It was intentioned that over a 10-year span that the NIH budget would approximately double. And sure enough, by 2009, the NIH budget moved from about $15.5 or so to about $30.5 billion. So that was great. There was a lot of buzz going around. A lot of faculty were hired by different research institutions and universities across the United States. And then there was a flattening between 2009 and 2015. And then in 2016, there was an increase under President Obama of a $2 billion increase in the budget to about $32 billion. And more recently, fortunately, although President Trump had proposed that there would be a decrease in the budget, fortunately, there was consensus in Congress to increase increase rather than decrease. So the 2017 budget is approximately now $34 billion. But the proposal by the White House is to decrease the budget by about 20% or so, which would be $7 billion. And that would have a huge effect.
And what that could ultimately mean to everyday people out of the lab, but the people who could benefit from the kind of research being done. What, can you even describe what that might be?
Well, a lot of what comes out of basic research is understanding how different organs work, but also understanding what happens when something goes bad. There are hundreds of diseases that, in fact, could be affected. Affected in a sense that we're not going to be able to identify potential cures, which then lead to real cures that could be taken to treat hundreds, if not thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals. It depends also on the kinds of diseases. I mean, there are rare diseases. You've had the whole spectrum. There are diseases that are not caused by a single gene or gene product, but they're multifactorial, but still understanding how we can manage those diseases to improve the quality of life of citizens, you know, in Michigan and also across the United States.
Final word, if you will, Doctor, what warning do you hope our policymakers in Washington will take from your research?
Well, I hope that they will look at their families and look at their neighbors and look at their friends and maybe talk to some of those kids and say, ask them, what is it that you want to do? Maybe even ask them, are you concerned about the noise that's going around, that there's a decrease in support for research? How do you feel about that? Now, for some, they may not be interested in science, but I think many would be interested in science. And I wouldn't be surprised, in fact, if some of those kids even say, but I hear this news that's going around, and I hope you will do something about it. And in fact, it's our representatives in Washington who really will have a major say. Obviously, we citizens hopefully will get the message across. For example, the March for Science, I don't know whether actually that had a positive impact, but it was positive in a sense that it got a lot of people excited. And maybe people in Washington heard the footsteps of that march. We have to do, I think, we meaning those who are involved in doing research, we have to make sure that we get the message across. Why is it so important to support science and research? And then hopefully those in Washington, D.C. will listen.
Dr. Bishar Omri, the Chief Scientific Officer of Michigan Medicine. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Still to come, the roadblocks to upward mobility for low-income families.
It takes a lot more than a mindset to rise above low earnings. It takes a lot of luck, and hard work alone is not going to do it.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump's proposed budget contains some breathtaking cuts to programs like housing subsidies, child care assistance, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and many other programs that serve the poor. HUD Secretary Ben Carson's comment in a recent interview on SiriusXM gives us a clue of what's behind this. He was asked what could be done to reduce the large number of people living in poverty.
I think poverty, to a large extent, is also a state of mind. You take somebody who has the right mindset, you can take everything from them and put them on the street. And I guarantee you, in a little while, they'll be right back up there. And you take somebody with the wrong mindset, you can give them everything in the world. They'll work their way back down to the bottom.
So we begin a series looking at the so-called working poor, who they are, what challenges they face, and what policy changes might help the most people. With us now is Kristen Seafelt. She's an assistant professor at the School of Social Work and the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Her new book is Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. Kristen, your book explores roadblocks to upward mobility for low-income families, the poor, the working poor, people who use the safety net. What does that term working poor really mean?
The way I think about it is people who hold jobs, you know, maybe they don't work full time, maybe they don't work full year, but their income is low enough that it puts them below the federal poverty line. So for a family of three, for example, you know, we're talking roughly about $25,000 a year would make that family poor by an official measure. Yeah, and certainly we can argue whether or not that's enough to live on, but that's how the Census Bureau defines it.
And in your book, you studied 45 people in the Detroit metro area, and you talked with them every year for 6 years, and all Michiganders.
Yes.
And you use a really interesting term for these people, Kristen, strivers. What do you mean by that word?
By that, I mean that folks were really actively engaged in all sorts of different activities to try to increase their earnings, to move into the middle class, or to maintain what little toehold they had in the middle class. So folks were going to school, trying to get associate's degrees or bachelor's degrees, trying to do training to get a better job. They were buying homes, you know, which is both a source of wealth for families in the United States. And also, you know, we think of it as a way to stabilize neighborhoods. You know, the more homeowners you have in a neighborhood, the more likely it is that people will, you know, be invested in where they live. You know, they were working as much as they could. In fact, you know, sometimes trying to start their own businesses when the jobs that they could get weren't paying enough or weren't stable enough. Unlike, you know, some popular misconceptions that are out there, you know, these are folks who are really trying their best to get ahead, but sort of no matter what happened, there were roadblocks.
So how does what you found in your study compare to what we just heard from HUD Secretary Ben Carson?
I think it takes a lot more than a mindset to rise above low earnings. It takes a lot of luck, and hard work alone is not going to do it. We've had some pretty profound changes to a lot of the institutions that used to once promote upward mobility. And so because of those changes, it's just harder to pull oneself up by one's bootstraps.
In your book, Abandoned Families, you say you have come to the conclusion that these strivers have been socially abandoned. How so and why?
Well, a number of different ways. You know, one particular aspect is just the way that higher education has changed. You know, certainly we hear a lot about, you know, how much going to college costs, but it really costs a lot if you are, you know, also trying to work at the same time, if you're trying to raise a family, and also if you have been lured in by one of these predatory for-profit institutions, you know, which promise a lot and deliver very little. And often leave people, you know, holding thousands of dollars of debt and then have a degree that's, you know, worth absolutely nothing in the labor market.
And yet our colleges and universities really are still serving that 18 to 25-year-old, that traditional
right.
image of college student, aren't they?
Exactly. They're not, you know, the way that even we at the University of Michigan are designed, we are really not designed, you know, to help educate someone who doesn't kind of fit that mold, which increasingly lots of students don't.
And at the same time that's happening, we're seeing jobs changing, aren't we?
Absolutely. You know, jobs, you know, we've certainly in this area, we talk a lot about, you know, the decline of good manufacturing jobs. But, you know, with that, you know, has been the decline in unionization and just general protections that an employee used to be able to expect. So a lot of the balance of power has really shifted away from employees. You know, so it's easier to get fired. It's easier to get replaced and downsized. And those sorts of commitments that maybe once existed between employer and employee don't really exist anymore. And there are certainly incentives in our public policies for employers, you know, maybe not to think of their workers as part of the family.
And public sector jobs were such an avenue to the middle class. I'm thinking of my own father, a firefighter. We've seen that traditional pathway to the middle class for so many people. What's happening with the public sector jobs that you find?
Those are shrinking, you know, and in many states, there's been a lot of effort to, you know, kind of take away any collective bargaining power that those employees once had. But, you know, it's not a growing sector, and it not only was an important pathway, you know, to the middle class in general, but it's been an important pathway to the middle class for African Americans in our country. So it's, you know, particularly devastating to that community when those jobs have dried up.
And where have we seen job growth?
Oh, in the service sector, in the low-paying service sector where, you know, jobs are unstable, they don't tend to have very good benefits, if any benefits, and there's really very little, if any, possibility for upward mobility.
So then what's the result? What kind of, you mentioned people working many jobs, just trying to put a patchwork quilt together of enough to live on.
Yeah. And, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how to survive, I think is the basic premise. You know, I think people who work in a lot of service sector jobs realize that, you know, this is not a career. This is not the job that you necessarily want to have for the rest of your life. But there just are so few career ladders. There's so few ways to climb up out of those jobs, you know, short of getting an education, but getting an education has become so difficult in this country.
So what is the social safety net? What does the safety net mean to these people who've been socially abandoned?
You know, for the most part, it means, you know, food stamps and Medicaid. You know, we used to have a cash welfare system, but that has almost disappeared entirely. It was reformed more than 20 years ago, which has really meant that it's much more difficult to access. If you work in a lower paying service sector job, it's harder to get things like unemployment insurance too. You may not qualify because of the way the rules are written, or you may find yourself up against an employer who decides to contest your filing for benefits because it costs an employer anytime a worker collects benefits. So that was something I actually saw happen quite a few times when workers were laid off through no fault of their own. They had to really fight to get any benefits that they really needed and were actually entitled to.
So not enough to live on?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
And what did you find people wound up doing to survive?
Yeah, a lot of folks took on debt. You know, it came through a couple of different mechanisms. So there's been increased access to credit cards over the last several decades, which on the one hand, you know, there's positives to that. And especially now that having a good credit score counts for so many different things, sometimes employers use it as a screening tool. So having access to credit in and of itself isn't necessarily bad, but you know, the kinds of credit cards that lower income folks can get have, you know, really bad terms, high interest rates, high penalties and fees for non-payment. And if you don't earn enough to pay it back, you just have debt. And then you can, you know, find yourself having collection agencies call you. Or you have to kind of juggle things around and figure out which bills you're going to pay one month and which you're going to put to the side. And that's a really complicated game to engage in. And it puts you always at risk for having something repossessed or something
shut off.
It's
an emotional calculus, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you give us a little bit of one person's story in your book that kind of illustrates this in your mind?
Yeah. So in the book, I talk a lot about Geneva, and that's not her real name. But Geneva, I think, it really sort of epitomizes some of these challenges. You know, she had a good job. She lost it. She had an accident that happened at work. Her employer, though, fought her claim to workers' compensation benefits. It was litigated. She finally got a settlement, actually tried to go back to work, but her employer wouldn't provide her with any kinds of the accommodations she needed. You know, something as simple as like a chair that had more back support wouldn't do that. You know, lost her job, couldn't pay the bills, lost her home, lost her car. But in all that time, as this is going on, she still, you know, she got disability benefits, but she wanted to do better. She wanted to go back to work. Goes to a for-profit college, ends up with a loan for about $12,000. And when she finishes, she gets a job that pays just enough to make her ineligible for any public benefits, but not enough to make ends meet, and also certainly not enough to start repaying her loan, which she was going to have to do very, very soon. And then the college went out of business, and so, you know, how much is that degree actually worth now?
So what does it look like when that safety net gets ripped with big holes or basically goes away for people like Geneva?
It just makes that scramble that already existed so much more difficult, and it's stressful. I think the levels of stress that, you know, people were experiencing, you know, were something that those of us who, you know, have relatively comfortable lives, I think, have a hard time imagining.
Well, let's take a listen to what Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said about the safety net programs that would be so drastically cut or eliminated under the Trump budget.
We're no longer going to measure compassion by the number of programs or the number of people on those programs, but by the number of people we help get off of those programs. We're not going to measure compassion by the amount of money that we spend, but by the number of people that we help.
What about that belief that safety net programs keep people dependent, keep them from moving up and out of poverty? What'd you find?
You know, I don't think that's really the case at all. One thing that public policy has done a better job of than we used to is to try to make it design programs so that families weren't sort of falling off of a cliff, that one day you're eligible, you earn a dollar more, you're no longer eligible. There's a lot more leeway in there. So some of these so-called work disincentives have really been altered. You know, I don't ever really find folks, you know, who are saying, well, I'm not going to take a job because then I'll lose this. You know, One of the things I think people don't really know as much about the safety net is that, you know, a lot of the workers, you know, the staff who administer these programs on a day-to-day basis, these are generally public employees. Their jobs have been cut back. So they're working overtime to try to process benefits. And, you know, things fall through the cracks a lot. You know, not only are benefits low paying, but it's hard to often get them just because of bureaucratic mess ups that happen. And, you know, I'm not blaming those who work in those jobs. You know, they're under a lot of pressure themselves.
And stretched very thin.
And they're stretched very, very thin. So just getting the benefits to which you're entitled to can be a real struggle. I talked to numerous folks who just, you know, lost food stamps 1 month for no apparent reason. You know, it was just an error. And then you have to wait months and months to get them back. So it's not a, you know, seamlessly run system.
As you study these 45 strivers and you've thought about what the policy changes could be to help them get off this hamster wheel and help them reach that goal of getting into middle class, certainly seems like one recommendation would be just do it better.
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, we have the technology that so that we could build better systems that would distribute checks better, or, you know, we do it in other programs like Social Security. We just, you know, put up so many barriers for families who are already struggling, you know, to collect like, what, $200 a month? It's not all that much money.
What other policy changes do you think could be seriously helpful to strivers?
Yeah, I think we need to start rethinking our post-secondary education system. And it's not just, you know, for some of the women that I interviewed, but, you know, it's getting really difficult for anyone who doesn't have a lot of economic resources to get through 4 years of an undergraduate degree. And yet we really need that. And we hear employers saying they need people with skills and with the degrees. So either that means investing a lot more, you know, in financial aid, or it means somehow restructuring, you know, how we do higher ed, or probably actually a combination of the two.
If the budget proposals that we've seen in President Trump's budget are enacted, or even if Congress adopts less drastic but significant cuts to all of these social safety net programs we've been talking about, what do you see for the people we meet in your book?
Oh, you know, it's hard to think about. I think, you know, people are resourceful, right? So, you know, folks will figure out a way to make do. There are a couple of different things I worry about. You know, people's challenges aren't going to go away. I think just the burden of helping will get shifted elsewhere. So I worry about what this will do to extended family networks. Will it mean that people who are a little bit better off economically will have to step in and help more of their kin? And, you know, that's not something that's necessarily, you know, we don't think of that as bad. We, you know, helping each other, helping friends, helping families.
But if they're just on the edge, what a drain to them.
Absolutely. And over a long enough period of time, this really then can have negative effects on upward mobility for generations. If, you know, if no one can get ahead because everyone's always helping each other, you know, that keeps people stuck for generations. You know, our so private safety net system, the nonprofits, the food pantries, you know, the meal programs, you know, those are shoestring programs anyway. They always have been, even in the best of times. You know, are they going to be taxed that much more because, you know, we've now cut the food stamp rolls down? You know, I think there's absolutely no problem with saying that we want to, you know, reduce our caseloads, but you know, how are we doing that? You know, are we doing that because we're helping people, you know, become better off and, you know, have incomes high enough that they no longer need the program? Or are we just cutting to cut?
The book is Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century by Kristen Seafelt, who is a professor at the Ford School of Public Policy and at the School of Social Work at the University of Michigan. It was great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Join us tomorrow as we continue our series looking at the working poor in Michigan. we'll talk with a mother of three struggling to make ends meet in Albion.
Are we going to have a home to live in next month? Are our bills going to be paid? Are we going to have a vehicle? You know, we just get out and make sure that they don't have to ever worry about those stresses and that we take on that.
That is tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Executive producer of Stateside is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Petulano Ali, Jacob Meschke, and Tyler Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.